Hi everyone, so welcome to this week's W3C CCG meeting. Today we're going to have a very exciting topic, a little bit different. Usually we talk about DIDs, decentralized identifiers, verifiable credentials, and things like that. Today we're going to talk about authentication, which is basically the linkage between the physical and digital self. And we got an expert here, David Waite, the principal technical architect of Ping Identity, to lead the discussion on FIDO and Web Authent. So before we go there, just want to do some quick admin stuff. First of all, just want to do a quick reminder on the code of ethics and professional conduct. Just want to make sure that we have a fruitful discussion here and hold a respectful conversation. All right. Anyone can participate in these calls. However, all substantive contributions to any CCG work items must be members of the CCG with full IPR agreements signed. So if you have any questions in regards to how you do that, or if you have problems signing up for the W3C account, just reach out to any of the co-chairs. These calls are being recorded, and the meeting minutes are automatically transcribed. So we publish these meeting minutes and audio recordings on GitHub about within a day or two, basically within a week at the latest. We use GG Chat to queue speakers during the call, so you can type in Q+ to add yourself to the queue, or Q- to remove. And if you want to see who's in the queue, just type in Q? All right, so let's go to the introductions and the reintroduction. So if you are new to the community, or if you haven't been active and want to kind of introduce yourself a little bit, please feel free to just unmute. I see mostly familiar faces. So if you're feeling a little bit shy toward the end, if we got time, feel free to just unmute yourself. All right, announcements and reminders. Any announcements and or reminders? No? So on October 10th, that's the week of the Internet Identity Workshop, we will be holding a special hybrid open house session at IIW. So that will be 12 p.m. Pacific time, 3 p.m. Eastern time. So Kimberly will be on site in Mountain View and holding that hybrid open house session, and then people can join online. I'll send out an email about it the week prior, so that time will be a little bit different because our regular 9 o'clock Pacific time kind of coincides with the open circle discussions during the IIW, so that will be pushed to noontime Pacific time or 3 p.m. Eastern time. All right, any other announcements or reminders? So a quick preview of what's coming. So next week we'll have Manu kind of talk about the selected disclosure for data integrity. And the week after that, we'll talk about proof of possessions at the application layer by Mike Jones. And then the week after that will be IIW, special hybrid open house session. And then the week after that will be selected disclosure mechanisms, different selected disclosure methods. And that discussion will be led by Ori. All right, any other announcements or reminders? No? Updates on the work items? All right. Before we get to main agenda, last calls for introductions, reintroductions, announcements, reminders, work items. Kalia, please.
Sure. The Internet Identity Workshop is coming up October 10 through 12, and it was finally confirmed this morning there will be an Open Wallet Foundation free IIW workshop at 9 a.m., 9 to 11:30 or something like that. Maybe it's 9 to 12, happening nearby IIW. The venue isn't chosen yet. But those of you interested in the Open Wallet Foundation work, it will be an excellent opportunity to hear about the code that is, already contributed, and also, an interactive part of the event where everyone who's there will get to contribute what they are doing that may be related or what they hope could happen with the foundation and its work.
Sounds good. Thank you. Any other last announcements or reminders?
Sorry, I'll just say that I'll send a link to the registration when it opens, hopefully before the next one of these calls, to the list.
Great. Thank you. All right. Let's get to the main agenda. So today, very, very happy and also very glad that David from PIN Identity is able to take the time to present and lead a discussion on FIDO and WebAuthn. I think he'll go into what FIDO WebAuthn means and what are the differences later, but this is a very important standard that's being adopted across all the major browser platforms that will contribute to more secure authentications and accessing our accounts beyond just passwords. So without further ado, David, the floor is yours.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I was advised to turn my video off once I start presenting. Just wanted to say hello to everyone, and I hope you enjoy the presentation. Okay. So I'm going to be talking about FIDO, the FIDO Alliance, and also the web authentication specifications, which are created within the W3C. I'm going to be talking about trying to talk a bit about how they fit into the larger credentials ecosystem that seemed appropriate for this group. A little bit more details on how the system works. I'll try to walk through step by step, but also give a bit of an update on the current state and some of the challenges, because I suspect that's an area where people coming up to speed have to do a bit more research. There's a lot of momentum and a little bit of a directional shift that have happened in the last, we'll say, year. A bit about myself, I work on various standards at Ping Identity. We do on-prem and hosted, mostly federated identity and MFA, although we have access control. We also have new identity verification and decentralized identity products. I participate in WebAuthn. I'm also vice chair over on the FIDO2 side that's working on the kind of hardware protocols. My personal focus is more on privacy approaches and technologies. How can we, make sure that the technology doesn't leak information or enable people to be tracked, even if, you know, social realities still would. So, getting into the specification landscape, web authentication, or often just called WebAuthn, is a working group. I believe it started in 2017, and its focus is on the client-side API. So how do I, as a web page, also known as relying party, how am I able to interact through the browser and do stronger authentication? This is done by basically exposing those devices or software that perform authentication, called authenticators, which create and assert credentials. So one of the fundamentals is that there's no inherent, like a federation where you have an existing account that's shared. A website actually says, I want to use this system. I want to get a credential. In this case, it's actually public private key based, in order to be able to prove it's the same user again in the future. This is also, by virtue of being the W3C, has user consent as part of the process. It's meant to identify or authenticate, I should say, people, not machines, and meant to be done so with their knowledge of what's going on, since that's a pretty strong tracking vector. The API itself supports both primary authentication as well as secondary being the historic source of the specifications. And it relates to FIDO because FIDO specifies the kind of hardware protocols, how do you work over USB and the like, but also can be provided by software, either provided by, within the platform itself, like Windows Hello, or via third party, like I think 1Password may have actually released something this week. That spec defines all the exchanges and also the format, since they're cryptographically protected. It also defines the extensibility mechanisms, although there's caveats in that browsers typically want to know what extensions are being supported so that they know the privacy impacts of those. So there's typically an allow list of what extensions are allowed, even if the authenticator itself might support them. Cutting away a little bit, because there's a lot of different options within WebAuthn, there's this concept of discoverability. So this is, I come with a browser, I've cleared all cookies, I've cleared everything. Can a website use this API to just say, try to authenticate the user? If there's been any sort of previous relationship, I can't see that as a website. Because of privacy, I need you to tell me, does the user want to authenticate? But I don't know who it is. So you need to have all the state necessary for tracking within the client, within the authenticators, what sort of relationships have already been established. Older school, U2F, which started around 2013 and is kind of the source for WebAuthn, didn't have any storage. So it wasn't capable of working this way. So you either call these non-discoverable or non-resident credentials. And that was only useful for second factor, really, because one, U2F doesn't provide a way of doing any sort of additional checks on who the person is, but also you had to provide a list of handles, and those handles were typically cryptographic information, either seed values or wrapped credentials, because that hardware was limited and had no local storage. The outpinning of this information is that discoverable and non-discoverable credentials form the basis of primary factor and second factor authentication. So are you supplementing something like a username and password, or are you trying to get like a fully passwordless, even potentially usernameless experience? There's a concept called user presence. This is a gesture showing that you, as a user, intend to authenticate. So that could be a button on a piece of hardware or on a software user interface, or it could be the action of taking the piece of hardware and bringing it close to an NFC reader. But that only shows that you have possession of the key. And nowadays that may or may not even mean that it's a hardware factor. So there's an additional concept called user verification. The authenticator controls the mechanism, but it's a way in the API to request that additional checks be performed. So very diverse potential ecosystem of authenticators. That could be a pin pad on a piece of hardware. It could be an activation code being gathered by the user's web browser or platform to unlock a piece of hardware. It could be a biometric sensor built directly in. But the idea there is that you're doing additional verification. This isn't just a piece of hardware found in the street, that this is set up in a way to actually verify the user. FIDO Alliance, a little bit older than the WebAuthn effort, started in 2013 with an overarching goal of reducing you know, ideally eliminating passwords and replacing them with stronger authentication mechanisms. A lot of their initial focus was around there being lots of inventions for stronger authentication. There were biometrics being built into laptops, for instance, but every one of these had a different integration strategy. And so widespread adoption just wasn't going to happen. You know, it's the purview of browser plugins and integration on a site-by-site basis. So they started the UAF protocol, which was a primary factor for interfacing with hardware and software authenticators. Google and Yubico contributed U2F, which was meant for second factor, which actually wound up becoming the underpinning for WebAuthn and CTEP2, which added back on top of that the idea of being primary factor by adding that additional memory. And so the CTEP2 spec underneath the FIDO Alliance is describing the hardware interactions. It also defines something called the hybrid transport. If you've tried WebAuthn and you've selected you want to try other mechanisms and you get a QR code pop up, which I can probably show at the end if people like. That's actually being defined by FIDO Alliance as well. And that's meant, these are basically meant to be not tied to like a particular ecosystem or a particular piece of hardware or a particular vendor for being cross-device, cross-platform mechanisms for authenticating. And then if you ever hear the term FIDO2, it's kind of the umbrella, almost marketing term for the combination of WebAuthn and CTAP. People have probably heard the term passkeys if they've looked at this space. Saying that a passkey is an alternative to a password is probably the best way to put it, because it's not really meant to be a technical term. It's more of a conceptual term. It's more of how do we explain this concept to your average consumer in a way where we're not really having to teach them something new. We're just leveraging their existing knowledge of what passwords are and just saying this is a better alternative. If you were to map it to a technical term, it would be that idea of those discoverable credentials that you can go to a website with no prior configuration on your local machine, just that prior registration of an authenticator, and log in. So you don't have to type in a username. You don't have to do a lot of things. The browser and the platform assist in helping you authenticate. And they provide that as kind of a consistent interface across different platforms, across different websites that want to use this technology. With the authenticators underneath, it's really a matter of user choice. So it winds up being a pretty diverse set. It could be that existing hardware. It could be the underlying platform, so functionality built in like Windows Hello, or it could be a relatively new, the idea of a third-party piece of software. So, you know, a lot of these are password managers getting into the space, although there are some enterprise pieces of software that also want to provide very specific capabilities. This, talking about why it's better than a password, this is kind of the minimum bar expectation of how those are better. One is tracking resistance. So while using the same email address as your username across sites is going to enable tracking at that level, the idea is that these credentials are generated pairwise per site. So each site gets its own unique key, and those can't be used to correlate you. Likewise, when I visit a website like a retailer or social network, they don't actually see I have any credentials at all registered until I give consent in the form of an authentication prompt. And even then, again, it's still just proof that I'm the same person they've seen previously and have registered a credential with. So it's somewhat a pure authentication factor. Another is breach resistance. So since this is all based on public key cryptography, even if the backup of the credential database table gets leaked, that it doesn't actually enable any sort of exploits. So a lot more resilient to people having to go and change passwords on a bunch of other websites because they might have used the same password and one of those sites got exploited, which typically doesn't happen. They just have more of their identities exploited. The third one is strong phishing resistance. So since these credentials are per site and since the browser is actively mediating and providing a channel, there's a kind of a DNS binding of those credentials. The cryptographic protocol describes the party that it's communicating with. So overall, it's as strong as the DNS and TLS infrastructure of the web itself. So much stronger phishing resistance. Email campaigns sending you to the wrong website won't really succeed in capturing a credential. You, in fact, won't even be prompted to supply the credential because the browser knows what it is and isn't supposed to be doing there. So where is this in the credential ecosystem? I'm a little hesitant in this group to talk too much about what is or isn't a credential. But these are pairwise, so they're not meant to be global. And there's issues with using something like an identity credential, like say a driver's license for authentication. In some cases, that might be appropriate, like the actual issuing authority or overarching government has assurances there that there's certain processes or certain actions that they can accept that risk, whereas someone else may not know that identifiers are stable or not, whether they move to a different state, whether they have another identity issue and have numbers rotated, or have any sort of action they can take if it turns out that credential is issued fraudulently. So being pairwise is a pretty big benefit for an authentication credential. Likewise, it doesn't represent any sort of certification or qualification. It doesn't really have any identity attributes whatsoever, nor does it represent any sort of personal authority or authorization. It is just authentication, just previously I registered this, I'm the same party as I was at that point. There's caveats, there's attestation. So especially as you get more into regulated space, you want to know how that user verification is performed. You also may want to know the security properties of that key. So for instance, are the credentials clonable? And there are mechanisms now for doing additional data storage at time of registration, which are used for things like, say, taking the underlying credential and kind of embedding it into like a X509 certificate form. So pardon the white slide. but this talks a bit about the parties involved. So you have the end user, you have the client, which is typically a web browser. You have the authenticator, which actually does the authentication process. And you have the relying party, which is kind of in two parts. Since it's a JavaScript API, you're typically not trying to authenticate the user for the purpose of the script running inside the browser. You're typically trying to get access to and prove that it's the user to, say, some sort of back-end system. This is changing slightly with some new extensions that are coming, but you generally have that kind of division of the relying party where it's kind of the front end and the back end. So the process is very similar whether you're registering your credential for the first time or are using it again, step one at the bottom is that the user initiates through the client browser. There's some sort of part of the presentation on the web page to kick off the process. Relying party usually wants to have its own interactive challenge, so it fetches that. That gets baked into a web authentic request at the JavaScript level, and then that gets turned by the client into, in this case, a CTAP request that goes to that piece of hardware, we'll say over USB. It does, in step five, a check for user presence or verification, like say it has a biometric. And then it creates a cryptographic response that gets sent back through the client to the JavaScript within the client, and then on to, say, the back end of the relying party to actually perform authentication. So talking a bit about the current state of things. So the market's been evolving quite a bit over the last year. While Apple had things in preview for a couple of years prior, or last year was really the start of passkeys, their public-facing system-wide credential system, and syncability. It was also when Google added passkeys to the Android platform. So adding discoverable credentials, unifying around kind of that terminology, it really changed the position of the market. Before it was, very low double digits or single digits adoption in sites where, you know, it's not a closed system where, say, an enterprise is giving credentials to people, hardware, and telling them that they need to use them, to having the ability to do WebAuthn, the actual authenticator to do it, not just browser support for interaction, being pretty much ubiquitous. And this caused a bit of growing pains, especially in regulated industries that adopted WebAuthn early. Because these platforms have different security properties. The big one is recoverability and syncing. So a mobile phone vendor isn't going to want people to lose their ability to log into every website when they buy a new phone or replace the phone that was lost or stolen. However, that means that you're no longer really interacting with a security factor. You're interacting with an authentication process behind that authenticator boundary, and that makes things a lot harder for people to reason about when they need to understand the risk and how this fulfills their regulatory requirements. So a bit of growing pains there. However, there has been significant investment on kind of the unregulated consumer space and adoption there. There's been several rounds of iterative user experience refinements. There's been greater adoption of the passkey kind of terminology. Also, relatively recently, there's been platform support for calling up the software at a system level, similar to how you have autofill from password managers today at a system level. So a lot of the consumer password managers are seeking to become passkey providers and to integrate either within the browser at that system level to provide people an alternative with, you know, different properties. It's, again, meant to be more of a diverse ecosystem where, you know, say a piece of software being syncable to Linux or having an open database might be very compelling for some people and not really that interesting for others. So with this, a lot of the metaphors have been aligning more with password managers. And that kind of go along with that minimal level of assurances that you can get from passkeys, which is that compared to passwords, it has better security properties, phishing resistance, tracking resistance, and resistance in the face of compromise. So that kind of breach list issue of passwords. We've seen the user experience aligning more with autofill behavior at login. So this is nice because one of the biggest problems with technology adoption is how do you educate the user? Does every party that wants to use the system have to take some responsibility for educating the user? So having it in the platform, having a browser-mediated UI that really only shows up if they've already opted into using the passkey system, that really reduces the amount of education needed, especially on, like, say, the homepage of a website. Not having, like, say, modal prompts that people have to figure out what the system's even talking about definitely reduces the chance of churn that adopting this technology would cause people to just decide they don't want to deal with it right now and to leave the website altogether. And so the hope is as uptake improves, as we kind of see wider spread adoption, further UX improvements, that relying parties don't feel the need to explain what passkeys are to the users, similar to how they don't have to explain what a password is today. So in progress, the standards, you have web authentication level 3. So this, it's referred to as conditionally mediated UI for that kind of auto form fill behavior. Providing more information about sync credentials for websites. So this isn't really meant for rejecting the credential. This is meant, so website understands, is this a piece of hardware where if they misplace it, they won't be able to access my website at all? Or is this something like something backed by a cloud account where if the user has a lost or stolen phone, they can recover access and be able to achieve kind of account recovery on that end? So what is the burden on the site? And they might use this knowledge to decide, for instance, whether or not they give the user to completely eliminate password login options. There's also been a number of quality of life improvements. One of my favorite is that the WebAuthn data, a lot of it's binary, being cryptographic messages. A lot of those messages actually go all the way back to U2F, so that there's compatibility with, you know, some pretty old, like 10-plus-year-old hardware at this point. And unfortunately, a lot of the burden in dealing with those binary messages and how to coordinate with like a backend system fell on JavaScript. So a lot of, like, if you bought a product, they'd have their own libraries for how do you interact between that backend server and your web page. Well, in WebAuthn level 3, there's now JSON formats. There's API built in to convert between kind of the API configuration or responses and to be able to get JSON and use that for API calls to a backend system. As with a lot of ongoing web standards, many of the features are already deployed. So the conditionally mediated UI has already been in browsers for over a year. Kind of its companion over in FIDO Alliance is CTAP 2.2. This adds that hybrid QR code based, Bluetooth based, WebSocket-based mechanism that some of you may have seen. And this is really meant to go cross-device. So how can I log into my desktop using my cell phone and credentials I created there, or even cross-ecosystem? So how do I sign into a Windows desktop using my Android phone? So a lot of this comes down to, and by nature of being in the W3C and having this investment by browsers and platforms, to being backed by an open world model where it's really the user's choice in what authenticator they use. And then the relying party is meant to evaluate how well that meets their requirements. For some sites, just being able to get phishing resistance and to get some of the properties they would normally have to do SMS OTP with out of an authenticator is great. In other regulated environments, the base level might not be enough. And the relying party may need to do additional factor prompts. And that's the public internet, for, you know, for private parties like enterprises or government to employer, government to contractor. There may be much further restrictions, even going down to saying, I don't just want to use this brand of key. You need to use one that came from our ordered batch with the proper serial number, with the proper configuration so that information is reported to us. But that's really private parties. Public facing, including those in regulated industries, are expected to honor the user's choice and not reject something because it became from a particular platform or because it doesn't have a particular capability. And a lot of that is both to prevent any sort of early adopter advantage, but also to really allow for a diverse ecosystem where, you know, say someone who has an accessibility need, that an authenticator can be built specifically for their use without having to, you know, say go and get approval from the top 100, 200, 300 websites of the internet who've decided to institute an allow list. But this goes counter to attestations. So the idea of how you know that, say, it's backed by a particular piece of hardware by a vendor that has particular security properties. So if I have, say, a security key fob that I'm selling into an enterprise environment, attestations are great. That meets the customer's requirements. That's part of the reason they're purchasing the hardware. However, if I'm a software-based authenticator, I have different motivations. I don't want to have fingerprinting. I don't want, say, websites on the internet to decide that since a password manager had a breach, that that password manager from this point forward will never be acceptable on a particular website. It's kind of a brand of penalty. And, you know, in the web space, we've seen what's happened with, say, user agent strings. And how, you know, a lot of browsers wind up lying, either baking in the names of other browsers for regular expression purposes or having a quirks mode where they just say, this is the value I have to return on this website in order for, you know, my users to have access. However, it is widely recognized that there's a gap between that enterprise environment and, say, a lawn care enthusiast forum in regulated industries such as banks and healthcare, where they may have requirements that the base level does not satisfy. And that makes it hard for them to adopt this system because they typically already have complex authentication processes that they feel do meet their needs. So a better alternative to passwords may not be worth the cognitive load. It may not be worth instituting just another option for one part of the authentication process, especially if they're going to do passkeys and then turn around and rely on something like SMS to try to do a uniqueness constraint. In that case, they're adopting this and it's not actually solving even any of their business costs. So it's a known gap. There's active areas, but it's also an area where the different parties have very different needs, very different worries, different goals. So active research and development, it is moving slower than I think anyone would like. But this is why most of the software-based and platform-based authenticators that have come out in the last year don't have attestations, is because there's not really a desire to have people locked into a particular platform, to have websites decide that they just aren't going to accept particular items. So they've been a little bit of anonymous in terms of how that credential is being sourced, what the backing authenticator is. So I can speak a little bit to those in Q&A, which I believe we're now at, if people would like.
Any questions for David? By the way, I have one question. So earlier in your slides, you mentioned that the web platforms have adopted the level one web authentication, and then you described the level three. So the natural question is, like, what is level two, and then is there a level four?
So level one was the initial version. Level two had a lot of kind of adoption features, more focused on enterprise adoption. So it added things like enterprise attestations. This would be how with either machine policy, so say a Windows or other EMM policy, or via policy on the hardware key itself, it could identify internal websites and perhaps release more information than people would normally be comfortable with, such as a serial number. So if I use an enterprise key on an enterprise site, maybe it uniquely identifies the key. And so they can, you know, track which batch it came from, which employee it was issued to. Definitely not what they want for, say, attestations on the public internet. In fact, FIDO Alliance does certification, and one of their requirements for attestation is, I think, 50,000 or 100,000 device batches. So you can kind of tell which weeks, say, a YubiKey was manufactured in, but you can't get too many bits of information about a particular user based on the key that's being used. Enterprise environment, very different requirements. So how do you opt in? CTAP 2.1 is kind of the corresponding spec there. And so it has things like if that key gets out of the employee's control, say they leave the company and they reset it and put it on eBay, making sure that enterprise policy is cleared out so it acts just the same as any other key from that manufacturer, not something that has kind of a surreptitious, an unknown policy that changes privacy characteristics. So making sure certified devices have a reset policy that would clear out any sort of policy that was loaded on them. So that was level two. A lot of cleanups, a lot of areas where, you know, there was opportunity for improvement. The discoverable credential bit came from that. And some of that was because in level one, there was a residency term, that resident, non-resident, if it's in memory. But it turns out that was really more the hardware roots from the CTAP side, the U2F side, and not really usability focused. And that actually caused some conflicts where, say, on the Windows platform, whatever you request, it's always resident. It's always created by the crypto subsystem and always put onto a file system because storage is not a premium. But those were actually meant to be usability terms. And so websites would find out that they never meant for a particular credential to be used some way, but it was still showing up in, say, a list of the user, even though it will never work. It was, you know, very inconsistent between authenticators and platforms. So this new terminology came about in level two. So there was a bit of more of a focus on what the behavior of things was supposed to be rather than what the hardware capability of things were supposed to be. The browsers themselves had different levels of adoption. So Firefox was lagging a bit. I believe they're now at level two, which is, you know, the current published spec. And then level three, I believe the goal is to have it go to CR early next year. But we'll see where that is. There's a lot of really interesting things that may wind up pushing it back.
Got it. And if you're a website, like, and trying to integrate with WebAuth, then you're just interacting with the platforms like APIs, right? Like, why do you care about the attestations of the hardware or different authenticators?
So attestations are kind of made to be a heavy lift, right? You could say some of that is implicit in, you know, optimizing for more of the consumer cases. Some of it may be a little bit intentional, because there's definitely an idea that for an open web model, attestations are something that they don't want a lot of people using just because they're there. So if all you want to do is WebAuthn to do basically pass keys and you don't care about attestations, you have a significantly smaller lift. Once you get into attestations, different hardware may produce different formats. The attestation itself doesn't really prove much. It just kind of identifies the make and model. So you'll have independent certification bodies like FIDO Alliance that provide tables to kind of map that into capabilities, security incidents, like, you know, this, the random number generator had a compromise, or someone figured out how to exfiltrate information off of the key. They kind of maintain certification levels and kind of active states of those keys. But you kind of take all that lift on in order to consume attestations. There's also, some of this may go away in the future, but there's currently also prompts to release those attestations. Some of that is because it's hard to know that a non-conforming authenticator that hasn't gone through a certification process, that they're not uniquely identifying the user, but it's also just a little bit of an additional burden for people to take attestations that if you don't need them, you really shouldn't be asking for them. And a lot of that comes back to that open web model. It just, people don't want websites to say, we're only going to accept this brand on the public internet. They don't want to get to a point where someone has to carry, you know, 12 key fobs on their key ring and figure out which one gets into which website just because of different security restrictions that, quite honestly, are arbitrary.
Thanks. Any other questions? And David, do you mind going a little bit deeper into kind of like the password recovery equivalent process, right? Like, and also, does the passkey kind of have an expiration date, and you know, or does it, is it like permanent?
Yeah. Sure. So there's no key rotation process. The idea is I can just register a new passkey, and there's a user handle provided by the relying party. So if the same authenticator gets a new credential with the same handle, it just creates a new credential and replaces the old one. So that's how you do rotation. There's not really an expiry otherwise. The relying party would have to make the determination that I kind of want a new one. In terms of recovery, so from a typical hardware security key perspective, there isn't any. And that was a huge adoption issue identified, right up until a year ago, that if I lose my security key, then all of a sudden I don't have a way to strongly authenticate these sites. So if their whole purpose of adopting this was to get like a AL2, say, level of authentication, you can't have recovery be the weakest link. And so, the whole water level winds up having to rise so that you're not doing strong authentication with email magic link recovery. But the guidance was, well, buy multiple security keys and periodically go back, have websites support multiple pass keys, and periodically go back and register your backup key from the safe with those various websites. And this is, even for someone in the security industry, pretty difficult. And so there was a proposal by Yubico to have a protocol that's kind of a future introduction between keys, where I could provide basically proof that my key was one that was mentioned in a previous registration or use. There were some prototypes of that, but they didn't really get too much adoption issue interest, mostly because every relying party would have to take the effort to support that new protocol and extension, or else, you know, you were still at the same state where there wasn't really any sort of built-in recovery story. The platforms basically treat passkeys as part of the sync fabric they have for passwords. So the private keys are protected and synchronized in the cloud through whatever mechanism they have. There were some improvements, I believe, to some of that. Some third parties treat it as like a cloud HSM, and you're really recovering access to use that cloud HSM. But the idea there was I still might get locked out because I might get locked out of, say, my Google account or Apple account. So you still need a recovery story. But the recovery burden is reduced on the relying party because it's a much more exceptional flow rather than I updated a piece of hardware and now I realize I can never get back in here. At the same time, the other part there is that whole hybrid that's in CTAP 2.2, the cross-device authentication based on the QR codes and Bluetooth and a bunch of other things. But the idea there is if I use my Android phone on my Windows desktop to get in, a relying party could just offer, it could detect that and say, why don't you just add Windows Hello? So you don't have to go through this in the future. You know, assuming this isn't some sort of kiosk, there's no reason you should have to use your phone to get into your desktop because we can just give your desktop access as well. And so that also means that it kind of aids you in registering multiple credentials so you have multiple ways back in. So none of that's a silver bullet. You know, nobody's invented the silver bullet solution for recovery yet, but it reduces the burden and makes it so that recovery is a less often behavior, and that therefore means that there can be a bit more scrutiny about it.
Got it. Thanks for clarification. And I have a business question. I got quite a bit of questions. I'm quite interested in this topic. I have a kind of a business question. I'm just curious, like, because, you know, the platforms like Chrome browsers, like, all have, password managers, right? And then it supports the web authens and, you know, and then on Mac, like, it integrates with, the touch IDs and things like that. So I'm just curious, like, what's the role of third party password managers, especially when the platforms already have these features kind of baked in?
You know, it's a lot of it is evolutionary speed. So a company dedicated to building user-facing or family or, say, enterprise-facing password managers has more resources that they're probably willing to put on those products. More desire to iterate and innovate. You know, very recent feature as of yesterday is that the Apple Password Manager added groups so that you could have a set of passwords and passkeys shared with your family. Quite honestly, I didn't think they would ever do that. And it's not because it's not valuable. It's because I didn't know if it'd make the cut because there's a certain amount of cognitive load and there's ongoing support. And from their perspective, it's a feature, not a product. So, you know, same with why would I have hardware in addition to software? I think a lot of it is, you know, the ability to cater to the needs of your customers. which may be different than the needs of everyone using passkeys. And so having a consistent interface across platforms, so knowing that it works identical on, say, a Mac and on an Android phone, any support they have in the future for something like Linux, which doesn't have a platform-level feature for WebAuthn and passkeys yet, but I know there's people that have been looking into that. You know, all those sorts of things differentiate the, you know, the accessibility is a area I'm really interested in seeing what sort of, you know, very targeted evolution could happen to help people with specific needs. And eventually that may raise all ships, that may become table stakes when people realize, oh, this is excellent. This is the way we should have done it all along. But if you don't have more velocity and more experimentation, then that realization may never happen.
Cool. Well, thank you. I think we're at time, and I just want to say thank you. Big thank you again, David, for taking the time here to present and lead this discussion and answer a bunch of my questions that I have for a long time about FIDO and WebAuthn. So thanks a lot.
Yeah, and if you or anyone else has additional questions in kind of this space, feel free to reach out. You know, there was talk in the past of whether or not the attestations that FIDO created were usable for wallets. Generally, I don't think that's a great idea, but yeah, that's all stuff I'm willing to talk about, perhaps in the mailing list. But if anyone has questions, you can also reach out to me directly.
Sounds good. And by the way, David, if you don't mind, can you kind of share the link to the slides to me after the meeting, or just like feel free to just reply back to the thread.
Mm-hmm. I'll send it to you. I'll send it as a PDF.
Sounds good. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Bye, everyone. Thanks for having me.
All right. Have a good one.